your NOI, your net operating income, is basically the total potential gross income, the most amount of money you can make on that property as of today. And the banks are going to say it's the lower of the market rent in the area or the actual rent in place. And that's regardless of what property you have, because banks want to take a conservative approach to the maximum amount of money you can make. They take that potential gross income number, they subtract the operating expenses, which is really, and I'm paraphrasing a lot here, everything but the mortgage and the capital improvements, right? The things you're doing to improve the property that are below the line for tax purposes. If you want a really good visual of what this looks like, look at someone's tax return who has an investment property. Look at an LLC who has one, and they have schedules there they use for tax purposes. Those are exactly the same way your bank looks at it. Hello, friends, and welcome to the Higher Standard Podcast, where we give you ultra premium, unfiltered truth when it comes to building your wealth and curating the lifestyle of your dreams. No games, no drama, and no shenanigans. I am your host, Chris Nahibi, and I'm here to help you distill the immense amount of information and disinformation out there on the interwebs and give you the opportunity to choose a higher standard for yourself. There are no gurus here, and no one gives a damn about how wealthy you look. I'm an attorney and a banker, amongst other things. Does that mean you should listen to me? Hell no. This is just full disclosure that while we talk about money, wealth, law, investing, and a lot of related topics, you should always speak to your own advisors for an opinion tailored to your unique investment perspective. I am obligated to tell you that nothing contained in this show is in fact legal or investment advice and is being provided solely for entertainment purposes. So sit back, relax your mind, and get ready for a different kind of podcast where we elevate your baseline in crispy, high-resolution audio. This isn't a different standard, it's the higher standard. We are going to talk today about one of my favorite topics. I do this for a living. It's my 9-to-5. I love it. The three things you absolutely need to know if you're going to be in commercial real estate. And if you're listening right now and you're thinking to yourself, hey, man, I'm already in commercial real estate, I'm going to skip this one. Don't do that. Because what I'm going to do here is give you the perspective of someone in my position, which you generally do not get publicly. You don't hear the chief credit officers of banks talking about the things that they see. And we see billions of dollars of transactions a year. We see such a diverse array of this information coming in from so many diverse places, whether that's direct from the consumer client, direct from the business client, direct from brokers, you know, whether we're selling in the secondary market to the agencies, whether the regulators are here looking at it. There's a perspective that I can provide because I've just seen such a massive amount of this for so many years, decades now, that I think will be really valuable for anybody who listens, even if you got the experience. So stay with me. Let's go. Let's talk about this in a calculated, forward way. So many of us dream of buying a home, may have bought a home, may have bought one or two rental properties, okay? And you need to understand that that experience, while teaching you some wonderful and awesome basics about real estate, doesn't really help you a whole lot as it relates to commercial real estate because the entire perspective is different. And don't let that make you feel bad. The only reason I'm in the job that I'm at today is when I was 14 years old, cold calling single family resident loan applications from my father back in the 80s. I wanted to know more. I wanted to understand how commercial real estate worked. And frankly, I didn't realize then how much of a completely different world it was. I was used to, you know, quoting things like loan to value. Hey, man, you know, we'll get you into that property. You know, we can get you at a 75% loan to value, 80% loan to value. I was so busy thinking about that and the cash flow of the individual behind it and looking at, you know, quoting rates that I couldn't imagine that one day, if you ever got into the commercial real estate world, you couldn't call up a bank and ask the question, hey, what's your highest loan to value? In most cases, that isn't going to help you as somebody looking for a commercial real estate loan. And this is point number one, okay? There is something called the debt service coverage ratio, sometimes called the debt coverage ratio, DSCR, DCR. It's got a lot of different colorful ways of explaining it, but essentially, that is the one calculation you really need to understand well if you're going to get into commercial real estate. Because not only does it tell you for every dollar in expense, how much profit you'll be making in the form of a ratio. So for example, a 1.5 debt service coverage ratio means for every dollar in expense you have, you're making $1.50 in profit. Okay. And that's a wonderful thing. Banks are going to use that to figure out whether they can make you a loan. And then you say, well, Chris, well, how do I know what loan to value I get? The bank will tell you a maximum loan to value on a letter of interest they issue or on their program guidance. Okay. But that is only if you can get there, if the property itself can cash flow and pay for a loan that high. And in places where the land costs a lot of money, California, Texas, New York, Florida, major metropolitan areas, okay? Those areas, you generally don't get to the maximum loan to value because you're going to have something called debt service coverage ratio constraint. Now, if all this sounds technical, don't let it intimidate you. We're going to break all this down. We're going to get into it. And all this is going to seem like trivial, simple, stupid stuff to some people. But as we get into some of the details, I'll explain easier cheat codes on how to focus on these things for whenever you actually get ready to buy a property one day and you have to look at and calculate these numbers. A lot of people online, and I see this all over social media, burns my soul, singes me. I hate it. They represent themselves to be experts, and they pride themselves on these really wonderful, you know, Excel templates about how they do things and look at things, and you know, they tell you, oh, this is what you need to look for an investment, and go to this city, and go to the, you know, go here, go there. Look, stop it with all that, okay? There are wonderful investments from coast to coast, no matter where you're at. They cost different amounts of dollars to get in, and everybody's got their opinions of different submarkets. That doesn't mean there's nothing in your market. And that doesn't mean that you can't get something in your market. And that doesn't mean there are not deals to be had. So take it with a grain of salt. A lot of these online personalities that are just trying to hype themselves up, whether they make money or not, they've got an agenda. I am not selling you anything here. I'm trying to give you the access. I'm trying to give you the knowledge. If for nothing else, so people stop calling me saying, hey, man, I would like to get a commercial real estate loan. What's your maximum loan to value? Just stop asking me that question. You should be asking me, what's your minimum debt service coverage ratio? Right out the gate. Okay. It's gone up and down depending on where you're at, what bank you're at. You know, I like to see a 1.20, minimum of $1.20 for every dollar in expense. But, you know, some banks go lower than that. And back in the, you know, before the Great Recession, there were even banks that did something called debt service crusher programs, or, you know, below 1-to-1, meaning that you could actually have more expenses than you have in income, meaning you were cash flow negative on the property. And they would still make you a loan because there was something known as upside potential. You could increase the rents, improve the property, get it stabilized. There were vacancies. You could do a lot of different things. So buying a single family residence, a 1-to-4 unit, if it's got one unit or four units, that relies on your personal cash flow. But if you're going to buy a commercial property, okay, that relies on the debt service coverage ratio being a primary indicator of what your loan amount will be, right? Your loan amount will go as high as you can until that debt service coverage ratio comes down to whatever the bank's minimum is. And for the purposes of this conversation, let's say the minimum is 1.20. So, well, Chris, how do I get that? Okay, well, your debt service coverage ratio is equal to your net operating income divided by your debt service. Those are really fancy terms, okay? Don't let that freak you out, okay? Your NOI, your net operating income, is basically the total potential gross income, the most amount of money you can make on that property as of today. And the banks are going to say it's the lower of the market rent in the area or the actual rent in place. And that's regardless of what property you have, because banks want to take a conservative approach to the maximum amount of money you can make. They take that potential gross income number, they subtract the operating expenses, which is really, and I'm paraphrasing a lot here, everything but the mortgage and the capital improvements, right? The things you're doing to improve the property that are below the line for tax purposes. If you want a really good visual of what this looks like, look at someone's tax return who has an investment property. Look at an LLC who has one, and they have schedules there they use for tax purposes. Those are exactly the same way your bank looks at it. Everything that's above the bottom line, your actual operating expenses, those are what your banks are going to hit you with. Now, your bank's going to take a 2-year average. But Chris, if I'm buying a property, how do I know what that is? If you're buying a commercial property, your seller should be providing you 2 years historical and the current year to date. Just for you, the buyer, to do these calculations and come up with a debt service coverage ratio, an indication of whether this is going to be a good investment for you. So if you're looking to buy a property and you haven't asked for those things before you even go to a bank to try to get financing for it, there's a fundamental disconnect there. And you can see how there's a parallel there to the single family world, right? You find a property you like, you know that you've been pre-approved for or pre-qualified based on your income up to a certain dollar amount. You just go find a property. Well, it doesn't work that way in the commercial side. You have to find a property you like, and then you get letters of interest from banks telling you that they're interested in financing the property with the terms that they have in place. And it'll give you a minimum debt service coverage ratio and a maximum LTV. But keep in mind, that minimum debt service coverage ratio, the number we're talking about here, is going to drive that. You hear, you know, different economic indicators that are out there, like capitalization rate, as a way that a lot of, quote, investors use to tell, you know, what the investment strength is of the particular property they're buying. And they like to use, you know, cross investment types. Well, I can get a capitalization rate in stocks or bonds of X and Y, and how does this property compare? And that's really the intent behind it. But as a guy who considers himself a real estate investor and a real estate guy, you know, more than anything else, and I do play in many, many other asset classes, but that's just my favorite, I can tell you I don't like capitalization rate, or cap rate as they call it, as an indication of whether this is going to be a good investment or not. I don't like it. It bothers me. I prefer a much simpler concept. And I think that everybody who goes into the space of commercial real estate would do well to remember this concept. Look at cash on cash return. How much money are you putting down, right? What's your down payment? And how much are you getting back every single month? What's your cash flow in? I'm extremely focused on cash flow as a bank, as a lender, and I'm extremely focused on cash flow as an investor, as somebody who buys this stuff himself. Because everything I do in this asset class of commercial real estate, which is a massive asset class, and that's going to be point number two here coming up, is to look at the cash flow. Upside potential is nice. It's a great thing to have a potential upside in cash flow if you do some things to the property. But if you're not going into a property cash flow positive, number one, it's super hard to get financing these days unless you go private. And that'll be our third point, which we'll talk about towards the end. And number two, it's really, really, really difficult to go into investment cash flow negative and not have a tremendous amount of scrutiny on your personal cash flow. So it's not what I would call an ideal place for most people to start when they're trying to get into commercial real estate. You want to find a property that's going to put cash in your pocket every single month. And if you have to wade through a lot of deals to get there, and you have to do a lot of research on how to do these calculations on your own, do it. Because that one thing will be a huge impact to you. That can change, you know, how your financial position is impacted during different economic cycles. So spend the time, get to know it. There are tons of calculators online to help you get this information. What I tell people is you can look from a tax perspective, how your tax returns are prepared, and you can see how the similarly situated properties have their schedules done. And that'll really show you how the banks look at it. Get your 2 years and your current year to date, or in some cases, 3 years historicals if you can. Try to figure out things from a cash flow perspective. Look at the rent rolls and the operating statements. If you're in the hospitality space, make sure you know the RevPAR and you know what, you know, trailing 12 months of income looks like. You need to understand these concepts. Now, I just labeled a couple different types of commercial real estate. So we're going to get to point number two. Asset classes and markets are important. Commercial real estate in and of itself is a very broad term, okay? You can't just say, hey, man, I'm in commercial real estate, and really expect anybody to know what the hell it is that you do. So I'm going to name off a few. I'm going to name off the largest commercial real estate asset classes. Multifamily, my favorite, far and away, housing. Office, industrial, retail, hospitality. There's mixed use properties that have an element of both. There's special use properties, which are completely unique. Think of golf courses, schools. If a bank in a worst case event scenario had to take those over, there's going to be very, very few buyers for those. They're there very specialized uses. So as a result, they're considered inherently riskier investments. There's also land and construction for commercial properties, like what we talked about here. If the land is zoned for commercial use or to be zoned for commercial use and you're constructing one of the other property types, and there's a lot of different subsets. There's also different asset classes as far as grades go, you know, multifamily, class A, class B. Let's not even get into that. Let's get into some of the basic concepts that you need to understand as somebody going into commercial real estate. Banks typically like multifamily because they're perceived to have less risk relative to the other product types. But there are banks who specialize in things like true commercial real estate. And if I'm talking about retail, that could be a retail strip center, you know, three or four shops, or a single shop on a standalone. That could be a big, massive you know, lot with tons of different places, an outlying pad with McDonald's on it, Anchor Retail, and all the fun stuff that you know and love whenever you drive by some of these larger shopping centers. So there are definitely different types within each one of these types, but you have to understand that where these are located, the surrounding market, all really matters. And that's why, because it's so complex, people tend to specialize in an asset class. Real estate brokers tend to focus on, for example, multifamily and just do multifamily only, whereas banks typically like one or the other a little bit more. So I'll see banks that do, you know, really heavy in office, industrial, retail, and hospitality in some cases. I know banks that focus solely on multifamily with a little bit of commercial stuff here and there, but they like to do it owner-occupied. Anecdotally, I will say one of the things that I think strikes people as weird is that the owner-occupied commercial real estate, so, you know, stuff that's really not your multifamily apartment complex unless a landlord happens to live in the building, which is rare, that tends to be actually considered a slightly lower risk compared to, you know, an investor property. And there's obviously differences of opinions there, but I'll tell you that an owner-occupied business property, let's say it's a big industrial building, as a bank, you underwrite the cash flow of that business and you see if that business has the money coming in every single month to pay for that space. And that business's ability to continue making that money depends largely on their value and use of that space. So the value to a business that owner occupies is completely different. It's their core bread and butter. Whereas, you know, a multifamily apartment complex or an office building or a similarly situated, you know, industrial property that's rented out as an investment to somebody else to use or different tenants, you might have diversified risk. There's not single event risk of that business going out. You could have several tenants that go out of business. So it's got, you know, a little bit more spread out risk, but it is less valuable to the ultimate owner. And typically those owners own other properties as well. And for those of you who are sophisticated, those can often be held in single asset, single purpose entities, which means that if something happens and goes wrong with that particular entity, the ultimate person who's the non-recourse guarantor behind it won't actually have any recourse liability unless there's the three bad boy carve-outs, which are standard, fraud, misrepresentation, and deceit. And for anybody who's like, what the fuck did he just say? Don't worry about it. You'll get there. Trust me, the longer you're in the space, you'll figure it out. The whole point of this is you need to understand that historically, prior to the Great Recession and since that time, things have changed dynamically as it relates to the perceived risk of these asset classes. I love multifamily. I love housing. And my thought on that is I think that people always will need a place to live. But as we've seen in some of the economic changes in the last 14 years, office space, particularly as a result of the pandemic, you know, are we going to be largely working from home? Are we going to change the way we think about office space? Is this work from home movement going to mean that we need less office space over time? I don't know. You've also seen Amazon come in and change the way we look at retail. Look at the malls that were massive in the 1980s and still, you know, really relevant in the 90s that are now vacant in some cities across the country. And we're not trying to figure out how to use malls. Ironically and anecdotally, I actually heard that Amazon's opening up kind of a mall concept in Los Angeles as a test, which is a funny throwback. Things almost seem cyclical, but who knows if it's actually true. And by the time this podcast comes out, it sounds like Elon Musk is going to have androids doing all the work. And I just hope to God Will Smith's back in shape because he needs to defeat the androids. But I'm on a separate topic. What I'm telling you is the pricing now has come down because of the risk profile and because artificial interest rate deflation for the last 14 years has really brought rates down to a historical low. You used to see multifamily apartment complex priced a little bit more aggressively by banks because it was perceived to have less risk. People need their homes. There's generally a lower default rate. As a, you know, 30, 40 year history on multifamily compared to the other asset classes. And as I've kind of noted, you know, office, industrial, retail, hospitality, these things all are kind of fluid. Think about hospitality, right? If you're a hotel and now there's Airbnb everywhere, how does that impact your business? Are you still booming? Are you not? After the pandemic, certainly they were blowing up. Really, when you take everything I just said for the last couple of minutes, you start to unpack it and look at it, you start to recognize and appreciate how there are a lot of elements here. And you can see how people specialize in an asset class. So that's number two. You need to pick a space where you want to grow and learn. If it's retail, commercial, real estate, do it. If it's multifamily apartment complexes, we're now best friends. Congratulations, do it. Okay? Those are the things you need to understand. Debt service coverage ratio as it relates to your asset class. And get good at it. Get caught up on the language. Know how properties are trading in your area. Understand where they are. Different areas have different concentrations in different places. Understand how your asset class performs in your market. You need to specialize. And the more you specialize, the better you get, the more you'll have answers to those questions. And then, and maybe then, you branch out. But I know people who have made millions off of being good or great at just one asset class. Syndicators, and I've talked about those in the past, they do the exact same thing. They specialize in one asset class. And Grant Cardone's of the world seems to specialize in multifamily. I might be wrong, but that's typically what happens. They specialize in the one that they love the most. All right, the third topic, which I foreshadowed a little while ago, lenders. Number three, if you're going to get into commercial real estate, you need to know how to get your money. Now, I've told you the types of asset classes to look for and the questions to ask as it relates to debt service coverage ratio, you know, the two most critical things. The third thing is who are you going to tell this to? Who are you going to reach out to? The more you know your niche, the more you know your debt service, your properties that you're looking to finance, the more you'll know which lenders will actually finance those properties, how they'll actually have their own specializations. Banks, community banks, regional banks, they all have a different perspective. And I will tell you again, for the probably thousandth time, if you've listened to me before, I believe in community and regional banks, the big box banks, the Chase, the Wells, the B of A, nothing wrong with them. But if you want to have a relationship, and we know relationships are the truest form of currency, you want to do that, you need to be with a community bank, a regional bank. And I'm not just saying that because that's my 9-to-5. That's what I do. I'm saying that because that's also what I do with my own real estate investments. I've gone the big box route. It is like a colonoscopy every damn time you go through, giving them all your financials, getting into the analysis. A community bank, I call them up. They already have most of my financial information. They keep it there. They know who I am. I get what I need on a timely manner. And I'll tell you, every sophisticated real estate investor I've ever met has had a very similar mindset as it relates to banking. So this is not just my opinion. There is a time and place for things like hard money lenders. I do recognize that. So what I will say is, if you're thinking, hey, man, I've heard a lot about this BRRRR strategy, buy, rehab, rent, refinance, repeat, that's a very common single family residence mentality. But if you're mentioning BRRRR in the context of commercial real estate, man, that's a risky endeavor because you have to find tenants for non-multifamily commercial real estate that's going to be a little bit more complicated in most cases and takes a little bit more time. Maybe depending on the market, maybe not. In multifamily, you're still filling up an apartment and tenants, and there's consumer rights there, particularly because you're considered a landlord, more so than the 1-to-4 unit case where it's a little less commercial emphasis, but still landlord. There is a time and place for that. I love the BRRRR strategy as it relates to single family, but if you're going into hard money to buy a property in multifamily commercial real estate, you need to have a positive exit strategy and understand it. Banks, lenders, regardless of their size, are going to look at you in the capacity of, what's the debt service coverage ratio? That is our policy minimum. You'll usually see that number be higher for true commercial. So multifamily 120, it would not be uncommon to see 130, 135 for office, for industrial, for retail, for hospitality. You might even see higher in some circumstances. Mixed use, special use, land, construction, all those things are there. There's a lot more technical indicators that banks will look at, and there's a lot more information they'll get into. But if you know your sector, you know your community, you know your area, you know the cash flow of the property, you're already largely the way there. You can answer those questions when they give you an answer. Some banks will be portfolio banks. They're going to keep all those loans in their portfolio. They're going to try to grow their assets, and their deposits, their liabilities, and their assets. They're going to try to grow those to the extent that they can. So they're going to keep them in their portfolio, and they're going to try to grow over time. They are less subject to the homogeneous nature that banks that are larger who sell into the secondary market to sources like Fannie or Freddie. They are beholden to their rules because they have to sell them in the securitization. They have to be similarly situated assets for people on Wall Street to buy them. We know it came up with hybridized, securitizations and led to the Great Recession, right? All these different types of risk and different variables in them. So people don't want to buy things that aren't very similar in the secondary market. So portfolio lenders will like to have very, very hard and fast rules. They're not going to deviate from their LTVs. They're not going to deviate from their debt service coverage ratios. They're going to stay super consistent. So you need to either plan to be in that box or find a lender that's more flexible. And those are typically the very, very small banks, because as banks get larger, call it, $5-6 billion plus, they have to do some balance sheet management. And that includes secondary market sales. Or you have to develop a relationship because of the truest form of currency. Ah, see, I did it again. You have to develop a relationship with your bank to where they'll want to keep your loans in their portfolio over time. And as you grow and scale, banks have something called a legal lending limit, which will limit the amount of dollars they can make to any one individual and or entity. So these banks will only be able to lend you up to a certain dollar amount depending on their size. Now, it can vary greatly depending on how they're regulated and who regulates them, and it can vary greatly depending on their asset class types and some of the things that they have going on, whether they calculate their legal lending limit on a quarterly basis, a daily basis, or a monthly basis. The point being is you will know the answers to all those questions if you find lenders who specialize in the products in your space. The easiest way to find out is now that you've picked a sector that you love, now that you understand debt service coverage ratio, now that you're working in this, maybe you're an analyst somewhere, you start to hear names come up of lenders that are consistently in your space. And those are the people that you talk to. Those are the people you build a relationship with. And those three things, my friends, understanding your debt service coverage ratio, your asset classes and markets, and your lenders in the space, those are the three things you need to know to be in commercial real estate. Thank you for listening. I hope this technical one didn't bore you to death. I find this stuff incredibly valuable. I can appreciate that not everybody does. You want to find out more, or you want to listen to something that's way more entertaining, you can also hit me on social media. It's at Chris Nahibi at TikTok, Instagram, you know, YouTube. You name it, I'm on it. Follow, like, subscribe. And if you found this useful, do me a personal favor. Send it to your friend. Let's share this because I need love too. I hope you enjoyed today's conversation on the Higher Standard Podcast. Make sure to hit subscribe or follow on whatever platform you are listening to this on. If you like this episode, please write a review and share it with us. You're getting the show up and running right now, so every message, every review, and every note counts. This show exists to showcase what's possible when leaders decide to uphold a higher standard for their businesses, their investments, their families, and most importantly, themselves. If you want to see more of my content, I post daily on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube, so be sure to follow me on your favorite social media platform. And with that, it is a wrap. And as always, I look forward to hanging with you all on the next episode.